Tony Blair and also the members, it doesn't seem that they have done anything final. That's why Netanyahu said it yesterday. He said that he will withdraw till the yellow line. And Yael Zemir said that this new line will be the final line for the Israeli forces to withdraw to and leave the rest. What is the rest? The shore and the southern part of Gaza, where the probably gas and oil
resources
there in the sea, in the Palestinian Sea, we have to wait. I guess they are not certain yet till the point and the map from Tony Blair and from Jared Kushner and from Witkoff to come to be implemented. Otherwise, the Israelis, well, they have meeting today, probably, or yesterday, between the Qataris, the highest officers in the intelligence services from Qatar and Israel and the United States. They have to meet in order to distribute the roles of each one of these teams. And probably also the Turks might join in order to finalize the map for New Gaza. And they differ about the arms of Hamas. Some of them say, well, let's give the Palestinian authorities these arms, or try to hide them under the auspices of some of the regional countries, probably Egypt, or probably Qatar with Egypt. Till now, I guess we don't have anything final regarding the withdrawal of the Israelis from the complete Gaza, and also the process of putting the Palestinians, where are they going to concentrate the Palestinians, which camps and what kind of assistance, and Netanyahu talked about the opening of Rafah
yes.
gate, and the Egyptians said there will be a kind of mutual or exchange between the coming and the going.
Okay, so will Trump be able to impose this on Netanyahu, taking into consideration that, according to
Absolutely.
The Israelis, the first phase has not yet ended? They're still waiting for the crops of the
own captain. Trump asked the president in Israel to pardon Netanyahu from his guilt and try to bring him innocent, and the Israelis want him to remorse or repent or say something about his actions, his corruption, actually. But till now, we don't know. We don't know to what extent Trump want Netanyahu to withdraw or to press him to surrender to his ideas. Because Netanyahu always say we want to continue opening the pressure on Hamas, on Gaza, on the Gazans,
yes.
He said. And they try about these collaborators with them, although the Palestinians, they have killed Abu Shabab, the collaborator and the spy, and who is doing great job for the Israelis, and they said
yes.
it. But I guess still the situation is too foggy to judge about the final steps for the map of Gaza.
Okay. In the occupied West Bank, despite the escalation, Hebrew media revealed contacts taking place between the occupation authorities and the Palestinian Authority regarding the situation of the Palestinian camps there and the conditions the occupation is trying to impose on the Palestinian authorities. How do you interpret the Israeli contact with the Palestinian Authority?
Well, I guess till now the Palestinian Authority is condemning the steps taken, the military steps taken in the West Bank, and otherwise they have no will, neither the plan to confront the Israelis in the situation of Gaza. And they are surrendering, it seems, to the American and to the Israeli to the Israeli forces and dictations. But I guess Trump said to Netanyahu, don't confiscate or try to put West Bank under your political hegemony. And Netanyahu said it, the political future of the West Bank till now is not determined, is not final. So they have problem with the Palestinian, the camps, the refugees,
okay,
from the 1948
yes,
to the West Bank. And now they are trying to cut all the aids from the UNRWA and from
exactly,
others.
And that's what I wanted to ask, why are they insisting on cutting from not only the UNRWA, but also the international relief organization from operating in these camps?
Their problem is that these refugees want to ask about their future and their right to return, to the 1948. If there will be any plan for peace accord, new accord, mm-hmm, they have to take in their consideration that these Palestinians, they have the right to go back, or if they stay in the West Bank, they have to have a kind of aegis or kind of protection or kind of aids from the UNRWA. The Israelis want to cut all kinds of aids from the UNRWA, and they want to kick out the UNRWA from the whole Palestinian territories.
Okay.
That's another problem for the United Nations and for the Americans and even for the Western powers, France and England.
Yes. However, some Israeli commentators have called for adopting what they described as an offensive doctrine, arguing that Israel has relied over the years on a defensive posture which can no longer work. Has Israel relied on a defensive doctrine in the past years?
This is a big lie. This is an empty narrative and stories from these fantasious minds, and they don't understand what kind of offense or defense they are talking about. The Israelis always have this doctrine of offense and attack against others, and the concept of aggression is theirs against the Arabs, against the Palestinians, their massacres.
Why do they advertise unlike that?
Because there has been, and still there will be, and now there is resistance against these offensive attacks, expeditions against the Palestinians and against the Arabs in Gaza, in Lebanon, in Syria. Look what they are doing in Syria. Look what they are doing in the West Bank. Look what they are doing in Gaza. And they are threatening and attacking Yemen, reaching and attacking Iraq. So this is what they call doctrine of defense.
Okay, so this is something
what kind
new
of defense? This is a big lie. This is a fake story about the political and military situation from the beginning or from the early century of the 20th century. Not from now. They have been doing these attacks
Yemen
against
and attacking Iran is new. They say that they should
attack any place where can be or might be a threat against the Israelis and might be attacked from these areas. But these areas haven't attacked the Israelis. The Israelis who have been attacking, and these
were helping
the Palestinians only.
Yeah. No? Isn't this new?
This is a new, but they are creating a new concept based on lies that we have been defending ourselves, as if they were historically there as a state or as a camp or even as a society. There will be a kind of, new mythology of the Israeli mind about their existence or being occupying the Palestinian land. And the Palestinians would say, we have been attacking the Israelis from the early 20th century, and they have been defending themselves. What kind of history, what kind of events, what kind of days, what
yes.
kind of thinking, what kind of ideas, what kind of philosophy, what kind of religion, what kind of a human being? They have been attacking massacres from Deir Yassin and Kfar Qasim and Meis and Hula in Lebanon and attacking everybody for the sake of the West and for the sake of the Zionism.
Turning to Lebanon, as you mentioned, Dr. Mohsen, and to the warlike atmosphere promoted by the Israeli occupation on this front, which has caused northern settlers to fear the resumption of war with Hezbollah, as indicated by the head of the Metula Settlement Council near the Lebanese border. What do you think of this discontent that is spread among the north settlers, as expressed here by the head of the Metula Settlement Council, Dr. Mohsen?
Well, they also depend on lies that Hezbollah is going to attack them or Hezbollah is there. Hezbollah is there because people are there. The southern part of Lebanon, the people there are having this eagerness, this longing for their land, for their. That's why they are afraid from the people of the south. And I guess if they are creating a kind of fear, a kind of, I guess it has been always from 1985, especially in 1993, 1996, till 2000, when the resistance in Lebanon achieved this great victory against the Israelis. And from that time, the Israeli settlers there, they think that Hezbollah is going to attack them. However, the Israelis always the attackers and the aggressors against the Lebanese there.
Okay.
And that's why the Lebanese in South Lebanon, they don't forget the either their massacres, the Israeli massacres against Qana and Kfar Tibnit and other places
okay.
in South Lebanon.
But do you think that the factor of northern settlements could influence the decision to launch a war, on Lebanon by Netanyahu's administration?
Well, here we have a great dilemma for the Israelis, for the Israeli military mind. And the existence of the Americans, we can say now America is controlling the area, controlling the Israelis and controlling also the Lebanese, the official Lebanese. And now the Israelis are stuck in the idea of not having been able to initiate a wide war or a war against Lebanon and reaching to Beirut. If
okay.
they want to do that, that means the international community, well, especially the French and the Americans, they see that any war might deteriorate the situation until they cannot control it
okay.
and Hezbollah.
Okay.
And not only Hezbollah, even the Arabs, the Arab people, I'm talking about the resistance in
yes.
the resistance, will regain its mentality of having to do something in order to defend itself.
Yes. Now let's listen to some of the Israeli social media commentary on the issue of Lebanon and Hezbollah.
Edgar, slowly but surely, Hezbollah is recovering and preparing for the next round. As long as the ideology of destroying us is strong and in place, we'll always find alternatives and new leaders. Israel Mitzaf, in Hezbollah's view, adding a Lebanese civilian representative to the dialogue with Israel is surrender. Washington and Riyadh forced the three Lebanese presidents to negotiate politically. Amdot Krav, it would have been better for us to keep the war against Hezbollah rather than stop fighting it.
Meanwhile, the Hebrew media revealed the security measures that the occupation authorities have begun taking to limit espionage operations for the benefit of the Iranians within Israeli society. Do you believe that the occupation can successfully or are capable of limiting security, intelligence, and even social penetrations of Zionists by the Iranians?
No, I think the future in the hands of the resistance
making this
and the Iranians. They have been making these campaigns for a long time, and
yes.
Hezbollah penetrated their intelligence services and reached to many information and data from the Israelis by listening or eardropping or all of these kinds of intelligence services.
Okay.
However, they have, technically speaking, they have, from the Americans, they have all kinds of, let's say, intelligence weapons. Weapons more than regular intelligence machines. They have more complicated and sophisticated machines. They can probably overcome some of their problems, but I guess the Iranians and Hezbollah and Hamas and everybody who have been attacked by the Israelis, they have to defend themselves.
Our time is up. Dr. Mohsen Saleh, President of the International Association of Political Experts, thank you very much for joining us.
The whole world is silent towards oppression, even one voice becomes powerful. IRIB English Radio, the voice of the voiceless. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
We have to have a very fair assessment of this academic and intellectual icon of early Islam.
His impact is more pronounced in jurisprudence that he formalized.
And tens of thousands of statements and teachings have reached us from Al-Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam.
This is Dialogue, an introduction to the most important dialogues and conversations of Imam Sadiq alayhi salam. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program is Dialogue, and I'm your host, Mahdi. Today, we want to talk about one of the great personalities in the history of Islam, Imam Sadiq alayhi salam. Please stay tuned. The sixth divinely appointed Imam, Imam Jafar al-Sadiq alayhi salam, was an incredibly prominent character in the history of the Muslims. He benefited humankind with his highly scientific achievements, many of which had never been seen before by humanity. Imam Jafar al-Sadiq alayhi salam's instructions in the acts of worship and transactions and his contribution in the field of legislation were amazing achievements that had not occurred before amongst the Muslim masses. And his eminence also had a positive and active share in the establishment of human culture and civilization. The sixth divinely appointed Imam, the son of Imam Baqir alayhi salam, an individual who was divinely appointed by the Almighty Allah, was known to have improved the general public lives of the people and the Muslims, and he was an individual, a divinely appointed Imam, a man from the household of the Holy Prophet, who enhanced human thoughts and discovered many of the secrets of this universe. Welcome back to your listeners. This is IRIB English Radio, and we're talking about the dialogues of Imam Sadiq alayhi salam. So what an honor it is to be speaking about the dialogues of the sixth divinely appointed Imam, Imam Jafar Sadiq alayhi salam. Now, just for a few programs, we would humbly speak about the dialogues of the various different famous people in the era of Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, and how in their dialogues they spoke about the excellencies and the superiority of Imam Sadiq alayhi salam. So of course, many of you probably know Jabir ibn Hayyan, of course one of the fathers of chemistry, if I'm not mistaken, where even in the present day it was Jabir ibn Hayyan's work that has led to modern era chemistry and its advancements. And of course, Jabir ibn Hayyan was a famous student of Imam Sadiq alayhi salam. So somebody once asked him that, you know, you are such an expert in this science, and you know, you have all this knowledge about this science, you know, isn't that so wonderful and great? And so Jabir ibn Hayyan, he replies and he says that, you know, really I have nothing, and whatever I have, it is from Imam Jafar Sadiq alayhi salam. He says Jafar ibn Muhammad alayhi salam is one of the masters in jurisprudence, knowledge, science, and excellence from the Ahlul Bayt alayhim salam. So of course he says one of the masters, because he's also referring to Imam Baqir alayhi salam, Imam Sajjad alayhi salam, and so forth. So this is what Jabir ibn Hayyan, you know, says about Imam Jafar Sadiq alayhi salam. And really this is a testament, you know, when the students of Imam Sadiq alayhi salam are at such a amazing level of knowledge and mastery, to the point where thousands of years later, you know, it was their foundations that have helped to develop modern era sciences. I mean, this is something that is really amazing. It's not something that one can just lightly say and look over and not reflect upon. And this individual who has such a, you know, solid position when it comes to the modern era sciences, he is saying that I'm a humble student of Imam Sadiq alayhi salam. He is saying that the real master in not just one science, but in all these sciences, in knowledge and in excellence, is Imam Sadiq alayhi salam. It is really something to take note of. And we should also put forth these things about the divinely appointed Imams and not hide them. Try our best to show the world these beautiful divine personalities, which of course will help to cure and heal and save the world that we are living in. This is Dialogue, Imam Sadiq alayhi salam. IRIB English Radio, our radio programs and podcasts on iranradio.ir. And now let's listen to Sayyid Muhammad Jawad Al-Ghazwini.
Another beautiful teaching from Al-Imam Sadiq alayhi salam is the following hadith. Implementing this hadith gives you peace of mind, my dear brothers and sisters. It brings you rahat al-qalb. It removes stress from your life. The Imam alayhi salam states, "Ar-raghbatu fi dunya turithu al-ghamma wal-huzn, wal-zuhda fi dunya rahatu al-qalbi wal-badan." The Imam says, having expectations from this worldly dunya, from materialism, always pursuing this dunya, wanting this dunya, wanting money, wanting power, wanting this position, wanting attention, competition for attention. The Imam says this leads to sadness, to depression, to grief, because you can never get enough of this dunya. We always have expectations. a true mu'min, a successful couple, a successful human being is the one who does not have any expectation. If my spouse serves me, I don't take it for granted. I thank them from the bottom of my heart. I appreciate it. Because when you expect something and the person gives it to you, right? You don't genuinely thank them. Why don't you genuinely thank them? Because in your mind, غصباً عنك, I expect this, I deserve this. So if you serve me, you did something to me, it's your job to do so. That's the attitude. And that's why you cannot even be thankful. And I've seen this, wallahi, I've seen this with a lot of married couples, right? Sometimes one side really goes out of their way to serve the other side. The other side is not still not really happy. And when you dig deeper to see what's going on, yeah, it's her obligation. It's his obligation. They're just doing their job. You ruin your marriage with this type of attitude. Don't have any expectations. Not having expectations puts you at peace. At night you sleep, you have no grudges against anyone. Because you don't expect anything from anyone. Your expectation is only from Allah. Not everyone, not anyone out there in society. The Imam says this brings you peace of mind and it gives you health. It's good for your body as well. So this is truly a beautiful, amazing hadith that we learn from Al-Imam Ja'far al-Sadiq alayhi salam.
Thank you very much for listening to this episode of the program, Dialogue. For more information, visit our website at iranradio.ir. Until another episode, God bless you and fi amanillah.
And he is the My father lost his arm before he chose to have children. He lost his arm during the war. And then it took him 7 years to cope with that and feel that maybe he was mentally able to help raise a child.
The things that he had seen, he would always have flashbacks, and he suffered from PTSD really bad from all the things that he did and saw while he was in the war. And he was very abusive, and he was very violent, and he would black out at times and think that he was still in the war. And there was times like we would get up in the middle of the night, me and my brother, and we would try to get up in the middle of the night to go to the bathroom, and he would be like hiding under our beds and grab our feet and pull us under the beds. And I mean, he had PTSD really bad.
He suffered flashbacks, lots of flashbacks. Many nights he'd wake up moaning and groaning, screaming and yelling in his sleep.
They would put him in the helicopters and stuff, and they would fly him all over and drop him off in the jungle, and they would get out of the helicopters, and the helicopters would leave him out there, and there would only be like maybe 30 guys. They were hiding everywhere, and you couldn't really run through the jungle because everything was booby-trapped, and there was pits with the spikes in them and landmines everywhere and tripwires, and they had these big logs that had a bunch of bamboo spikes on them, and they'd put them up in the trees. When you'd walk by and you'd trip a stick or whatever, it would fall down out of the tree and impale people. And there was, he said there was times that while they were on the battlefield that he would have to go, and like his friend would be walking right in front of him, and he would step on a landmine and pieces of his friend would fly all over him, and he would have to pick up the pieces and put them in his backpack and carry them out.
He spent a lot of time by himself, very quiet. We were raised with war decor in our home, lots of Vietnam memorabilia, pictures and videos and books and that sort of thing. So it was always around us, and we always knew what had happened to our father. We never knew him any other way, so we always knew what had happened to him.
He just couldn't take it anymore. He tried to drink the pain away. He tried to work it away. He tried to tell me and my brother everything that he went through. He tried talking about it. He tried everything. And when he first got there and everything, he was just out of high school, and what he encountered when he got over there was not what he expected at all. One of the missions that he had got sent on when he first got here was that they went into a village, and the whole time I've been here, I've been trying to ask people and everything. And the other day, we were at another VAVA office, and we were there with the general, and when he started to open the book, it was mentioned that my father was in Chu Lai. Everybody that was in there said, "Oh, Chu Lai." And it kind of made me start to think, well, what went on in Chu Lai that was so bad that everybody knows about it? And he was explaining all that. But then when he found Chu Lai on the map, he pointed at it, and he cried and shut the book and pushed it away from him. And that really hit home, because that's where my dad was at. And then when we got to the museum and I found where his company and everything was at, and I saw it on the wall, and then I saw where they slaughtered all them women and children. And my dad was only 19 years old when he joined the military, when he came to Vietnam. So at 19 years old, that's what they told him to do. And they made him kill women and children. There was like 500 of them. It wasn't like just one or two or three. It was 500 women and children. And like 70-something of those women were pregnant. So they killed the babies too. And that was the first week that my dad was here. And then he still had 13 more months to go after he had to do that. And he had to go through, I don't even know how many villages they dropped him off at, that they had to do the same thing, because that's when, during the war, it turned into basically a genocide, and everything that was out there, they killed it. Men, women, children, babies, dogs, cats, pigs, everything. They just went out there and they killed everything that they came in contact with.
In the sense that he followed directions, that he did what he was supposed to do. However, he harbored a lot of guilt for many, many years about the things that had happened here during his time, and the things that he was told to do, the things that he had to do in order to survive. He had terrible nightmares.
Another part of that story is that the Vietnam veterans in general were shunned by, you know, World War II veterans and Korean War veterans and things. They were not accepted when they came home by the very people they wanted to emulate. American Legions and stuff, because they didn't win the war, they weren't real soldiers, and they didn't have a place there with the real military heroes. You're from Vietnam, and they smoke, and they, you know, do drugs, and they kill people, so they're bad.
I know of twice that he had tried to kill himself, and the second time that it happened, it was Christmas. And he was having a really tough time. Christmas was very difficult for him. All of his family was already gone. And then just with the PTSD, he had taken a gun and had loaded it. And thankfully had put the wrong bullet in the gun. And so when he put the gun to his head and he fired it, it misfired and it didn't go off. But we knew about that story, and that was always something that we had feared, that he would take his own life.
I got a ride from my dad, and I went back to the state of California. It was Father's Day of 1997. I was coming home, and when I got to the house, I noticed there was a bunch of police cars outside of my house, and I thought maybe somebody had hurt somebody in my family, or maybe I was in trouble or something. I didn't know, so I hurried up and I pulled in the driveway, and I asked them what was going on, and they said that they needed to talk to me. So I went to the side with them, and I started to talk to them, and they told me that there was some people that were riding some motorcycles, and they had found my dad's body out in the middle of the desert in his car, and that he had committed suicide. And it was so hard for me, because all my life, my dad was always there. He always tried to help me. He helped take care of me. He helped make sure that I had my prosthetic legs and everything. And just all of a sudden, all at once, all of that was gone.
This war in Vietnam, guess what? It wasn't going like the other wars that the United States had been involved in. They think the idea that, you know, maybe America didn't win like they thought they were going to, or that there was subversive reasons for us getting into the conflict or the war itself, that America mismanaged their military, or they were after natural resources, or they just wanted land close to China. There is so much controversy just around those parameters.
The people actually got to see the war on TV. It was broadcast. They showed all the people that were getting blown up and all the kids that were getting sprayed and all the death and destruction of what the war was actually had going on in it. And once the American people saw how awful war really is, because most of the time in America, because nobody attacks America on their own soil or anything like that.
General, how would you assess yesterday's activities and today's? What is the enemy doing? Are these major attacks or...
This is the main Vietnamese language radio station in Saigon.
661 had ordered to get the snipers out.
When the American people saw this, they started having riots in the street. They started protesting at the government. They started, like, just having all kinds of problems in the United States over it.
So many years after 1975 that it's still in infancy. Like, I don't think historians even know what to write about it. I don't think they know what's real. I don't think they know what's false about it, what's mythological about it, anything. I think at first it came out of the veteran's mouth, my kids are sick, I'm sick, and they said, guess what? You're just a bunch of baby killers. You're just a bunch of whiners. You're a bunch of drug addicts. Now you just want a free handout. That's what they were met with.
Agent Orange was a safe product when it was used in the Vietnam War, and it's a safe product today.
We don't mean to say that there isn't an Agent Orange effect, but at this point in time, we don't seem to see anything that confirms that there's something there specifically.
Just hours before, thousands of Vietnam veterans were supposed to be represented in court against seven chemical companies. There was an out-of-court settlement.
Many of my brothers have died. Well, you sat up there and played political.
Gentlemen, we can't wait 20, 30, 40 years.
I think they just try to sweep it under the rug so nobody knows, so that people won't be trying to go, well, wait a minute, I have a bad liver, or wait a minute, I have a brother that's missing an arm and we've never had birth defects in our family, or wait a minute, now I know why you don't have any legs, and all that. And then for all the people to come together and sue the chemical company, I think that's what their issue is. I think they don't want everybody to know about the Agent Orange, because if everybody knew how awful it was, and that the government, they would have to pay for medical bills and all kinds of stuff, and they don't want to do that, so they try to hide it and pretend like it never happened.
It's just still on the cusp. It's just out on the edge. Nobody will take it and pull it in. Very famous actor in the United States, Tom Hanks, currently doing The 60s. It's a documentary series that's been showing on CNN. I waited on bated breath. You know, he's talking about the 60s and the Vietnam War and showing film and how it affected. I was waiting. Come on, come on. Nothing. I went to a speech with journalists who were here during the war who weren't in the military but were journalists, very famous journalists in Pittsburgh a couple months ago. I waited. Come on, something, say something. Sorry. It makes me so angry. They just erase our history. They erase it. It's gone. It doesn't exist. They don't care. And that has been what we've heard our entire lives. You're controversialist. You just want controversy. You're just making stuff up. No, it's happened. They talked about everything. They talked about the strife. They talked about this and that and what it was like to be here and how the troops were and what it was like in the... Say something. You come here as a journalist and you stayed in Vietnam. You were able to see both sides of the story. And you've been back to Vietnam. And you talk about it. Say something. You know that the children here are still suffering. You know that the Vietnam vets are suffering. Say something, nobody. You have people who are suffering, who have suffered their entire lives because of decisions people made in an office somewhere. They made the decision to spray this stuff. This is going to be a good idea. We're going to save people. People still today claim Agent Orange saved people. Okay, maybe it did. But those lives were worthwhile, and I don't diminish that at all. But there are millions of us that are suffering because of this chemical.
Seeing that these people have taken me in, like when we went to the Friendship Village and those Vietnamese veterans that came out, they were the NVA. They were the ones that were at war with my dad. And my dad probably shot at some of them, and some of them probably shot at my dad. And when I came face to face with those guys, that was a pretty intense moment because I didn't know what to expect. I didn't know if all of a sudden they were gonna have a flashback because they saw an American face or I just had no idea what to expect. But after he sat there and looked at me in my eyes for a good minute, and he came over there and he gave me a big hug, and he told me that Vietnam doesn't want war. They don't want to hate the American people, that they just want to live in peace from now on. And
come and I've been able to put faces. It's been a wonderful experience to get the second side of the story. Every conflict, every problem has two sides. I'd been raised with one side of the story. Now I've gotten the second side of the story, and now I can take both those elements and put them together and formulate something to share with my children.
Just like my dad, I'm not going to lie about things when I get back to the United States and try to make it look nice or do anything. All my friends and family and stuff, I'm going to tell them how my trip was.
Once I came to Vietnam, I said, okay, this is more. This is more. This is bigger. This is bigger than Heather. Because a lot of my life was trying to deal with what happened to me. And when I came here and understood that the problem was way, way, way bigger than just me, or just a few of the kids that I had kind of connected with in the United States, I understood that I couldn't go back to just thinking of me and my story and my problems and those things. I knew I had to do more.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
It guides us through life. It has taught us everything. We should learn and appreciate what it gives us. And try to apply them to our daily lives. How is it possible? By means of Quran.
این خوندن قرآن و تلاوت قرآن قدم اول است برادران من این قدم آخر نیست
Reading and recitation of the Quran is the first step brothers not the last one
هو الذی ارسل رسوله بالهدى ودین
It is he who has sent his apostle with the guidance and the religion of truth that he may make it prevail over all religions though the polytheists should be averse.
تلاوت قرآن با صوت خوش با آداب که شیوه خاصی دارد موسیقی خاصی دارد روش خاصی دارد
Recitation of the Quran in nice tones should be performed according to particular methods and tones. But it's not enough.
مشکل بزرگ مسلمانان دنیا دوری از قرآن. دوری از قرآن.
Muslims' major problem is losing touch with the Quran. Quran, Quran.
علم فقه از علوم شریفه اسلامی است.
فقه or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamate is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
We
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. We're welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hujjatul Islam Qaraati. Please stay tuned. The night of Qadr is the night of gratitude. The way to give thanks is that, at the very least, on the night of Qadr, the main body of our activities in mosques should revolve around the Quran. We recite supplications. On the night of Qadr, we recite the supplication of Al-Ghawth, Al-Ghawth, it means help, oh help. Well, eulogies, mourning ceremonies, and speeches are very good, but the Quran's share is not given. It's as if the bank of the night of Qadr is a Quranic night.